I am Plata on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Ken Dryden joins me now. He has just published Game Change, The Life and Death of Steve Montador and the Future of Hockey. The book looks at Steve Montador's career in the NHL and how the multiple concussions he sustained in his playing career resulted in his death at 35 and the subsequent diagnosis of chronic traumatic encephalopathy. Mr. Dryden does extensive research interviewing former players as well as leading figures in the field of neurobiology and sports concussions. He also tells us the story of Mr. Montador, whose life, though it ended tragically, could spur changes to the sport of hockey. Ken Dryden writes of what the NHL can do and what fans, players, and parents alike can do to make the sport safer. Ken Dryden was a goalie for the Montreal Canadiens during the 1970s, during which time the team won 6 Stanley Cups. He was a member of Team Canada 1972. He is a member of the Hockey Hall of Fame and the Canadian Sports Hall of Fame. He is a former member of Parliament and Cabinet Minister. He is the author of 5 previous books, including The Game and Home Game, written with Roy McGregor. This new book is published by Signal, which is an imprint of McClelland and Stewart. Ken Dryden was in town earlier this week for an appearance with the Vancouver Writers Fest. Please welcome to the Plant Online program the Honorable Ken Dryden. Mr. Dryden, good morning.
Good morning, Joe.
Is there a way to predict or see the symptoms of what Steve Montador had and perhaps prevent chronic traumatic encephalopathy later on, or earlier, I should say, than Mr. Montador?
Not at this moment. The only way that CTE can be confirmed is in a post-mortem examination. I think that what you can see ahead of time are other symptoms, and so you can see a patient that has memory problems that maybe is of a certain age that you don't imagine and expect, problems also with anxiety, with depression, with a gradual greater inability to deal with problems and any kind of complexity. One of the things that people who are scientists and researchers, they're always looking for better technology so they'll be able to see inside the brain to confirm confirm problems. But then there are neuropsychologists who can't see the concrete brain, but they can see the concrete person, and they see these weird behaviors. And if there's something that is weird, they know that there's something that's wrong. And so these are the kinds of things that you are able to see pretty well if you choose to see them and if you choose to respond to them.
Yeah, and so in Steve Montador's case, what were some of the symptoms or what were some of the behaviors that people were seeing of
him?
Well,
they were that. I mean, they were those things like, he had real memory problems. And not just the, I don't know where my keys are, or you walk into a parking lot and you can't quite remember where your car is. Well, it might not be, his car might be in another lot. His keys, it would be a constant thing. As his father found out later that he had on speed dial a dealer in Toronto, and he would be just calling him frequently about new keys.
Yeah.
That he had these problems of anxiety. He was suffering from depression. And Steve was a smart guy, and he was somebody who was interested in all kinds of different things, and at significant levels. I mean, he was really capable of dealing with people who were very competent and very accomplished in a lot of different fields. As in the last year or two of his life, he had a hard time piecing together things, making sense of things. There were a lot of things that were there to be seen.
So we'll talk about what you prescribe as to what hockey can do, but I'm interested in Steve's life because it's a fact.
Right.
It also began here. He was born in Vancouver, wasn't he?
That's right. He was originally from Richmond, and then the family moved to the Toronto area, to Mississauga, where he had most of his grown-up years.
And hockey was such a part of that family's life, even from the beginning, right?
Yeah. No, I mean, he was somebody who loved to, he was a very physical kid. He loved to play on the street. Any kind of game that was going on, he'd play. And so it would be baseball or lacrosse or soccer in the summer, and baseball, pretty much year round, or I'm sorry, hockey pretty much year round. Mm-hmm. And then he joined teams, and he was never the best player on his teams. He was a defenseman, and he'd be a good player on a team. He started out playing double A hockey rather than triple A. And then when it was Pee Wee hockey, one of the big minor hockey organizations in the Toronto area is called the Toronto Marlboros. And that's who he played for. And played in the Quebec Pee Wee tournament and against a lot of players who went on to NHL careers. But again, he was just a good, solid player, on those teams. And really, he never was a star. I mean, at any other age group, he was good enough to be drafted in the third round in the junior draft, and had a career that played three or four years. Really, 4 years in junior hockey, went undrafted through a couple of NHL drafts, and after playing an overage year in junior, he was signed as a free agent by Calgary and made the St. John Flames in the American League out of training camp. That if not, he would have been sent to an East Coast team in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. And then played as a first year as a mostly regular, but oftentimes not. And then played that much more in his second year, got into a couple of games with the Calgary Flames. Mm-hmm. And then really it was the year that Calgary went to the Stanley Cup final that he was in Calgary for pretty much all of the year. But would play some games, be a healthy scratch for others. And then when the playoffs came around, the Flames had kind of come from a really pretty mediocre first half, and then they got hot. They traded for the goalie, mm-hmm. but he was a really good goalie, and they ended up making the playoffs, and then they got hot, and they ended up playing three division winners and knocked off all of them. They beat Vancouver, they beat Detroit, and then they played San Jose in the conference finals. And Steve was a healthy scratch for the first six games of the opening series against Vancouver. Then there was an injury, and he came in to play. And Mike Commodore was another extra defenseman, and with injuries, he got called in to play. And both of them played the rest of the playoffs. And in that first round, or that third round series, in the first game against San Jose, the game went into overtime. And Steve scored the winning goal in overtime. Mika Kiprusoff is the goalie that I was trying to remember.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they had two stars. I had Kiprusoff and Aginla. And Marty Jelena, who was a good all-round player, and then, as they would describe themselves, the rest were kind of grinders.
Mm-hmm.
And they made it to the finals against Tampa Bay, and Tampa Bay beat them.
So what I'm trying to figure out, because I'm not a hockey fan at all, is how different the game is for in Montador's time and how it's changed his life, as opposed to, say, players of your vintage even before.
Yeah.
I mean, has the game changed a great deal?
Yeah, it has. And the biggest changes really are in the speed of the game. And it's not that players, if there was a match race between the fastest players of when I played and the fastest of Steve's time or even now, there wouldn't be much difference. But it was the way in which teams were coached and how they decided to use their players. That historically hockey was a game, which is hard to believe, but where there were no substitutions. You started a game and you played the whole game. It was like soccer, you know, in that regard. Then a few decades into hockey's history, things changed. Then, you know, substitutions were allowed. Well, then once you got substitutions, you don't have to play the whole game. So then you can rest every so often and you can start to play at a higher speed. But for a long time, that it wasn't played that way or understood that way. And so players still played for very long stretches. And for the first 50 years of hockey, there was no forward pass that was allowed. You could only pass backwards. And so the game moved at the speed of the puck carrier rather than at the speed of the puck moved forward with a pass. Well, then once you get into the 1950s, when I was a kid and watching, the players were playing about 2 minutes long each shift. But when it's 2 minutes long, you're still kind of coasting, looking to see something. If you see an offensive chance, you burst towards it for it. Same if you've got a defensive problem. But otherwise, it's kind of coasting, circling, and that's the pace in which you play. By the time I was playing in the 70s, coaches had come to realize that, you know, is that we can have rested players. I mean, we can move players over the boards and who are rested. They don't need to rest on the ice circling around. So by this time, the shifts were down to about a minute or a little bit more than a minute. Well, then when you come to now, the shifts are about 35 seconds, 37, 40 seconds long. And what the coaches expect of players and the style of play that the teams will use has to do with full sprint all the time. So you come over the boards, and for 35 seconds, you sprint like you're coming out of the starting blocks in a 100-meter race. And then at 35 seconds, you head off, and it's like you're passing the baton to the next player, and he comes on for that full sprint, and then to the next and the next, and it's really a 60-minute sprint, and at that kind of pace. Well, when you play at that pace, first of all, you have to be trained at that pace, so it means that much more off-ice training, off-season training, and the players come to be in better shape to play that high-tempo game. But second of all, what happens is that there's much less space and much less time for players to do things on the ice. It's a much more challenging game in that way. You've always got at least one player right on you, and often two. Well, what that means in the end is that there are many more collisions, you know, that happen because players are in this close proximity and moving at these higher speeds. And the force of the collisions is that much greater, because the players are moving at a faster speed, and you know, and additionally to this is that players are bigger, and they're not immensely bigger, but they're somewhat bigger, and so the combination of the extra size, the extra speed, the greater frequency of the collisions leads to the greater force of collisions leads to a game that puts you know players in at much greater risk.
So,
and that's the game that Steve played in.
Yeah. So before we get into the reforms you have, to the improvements you have to hockey, is there anything that could be done to say the equipment that hockey players use?
Yeah, the equipment is always changing and always improving, and in a lot of ways. I mean, if you looked at shoulder pads or even elbow pads, you know, of even 20 or 30 years ago, let alone 40 or 50 or before that, you know, that they are much, you know, they're much bigger, but at the same time, they're lighter. And so you have, a player has much better protection in that way. It was only beginning in around 1980 that it was mandated that any new player into the NHL had to wear a helmet. And so, you know, pretty quickly, almost every player was wearing a helmet, and every player does wear a helmet now. And those helmets are better in lots of different ways. The problem has been that there, you know, that in studies that have been done on the effectiveness of helmets for the protection against concussions have shown that essentially helmets have had no impact. Mm. They have an impact on an effect on certain things, and they seem to be able to lessen the force of the impact when it's a direct blow, and so a player is much less likely to have a fractured skull on the ice because of helmets. But in terms of concussions, essentially no effect. And I think in part it's that a lot of concussions come not from the direct straight ahead blow, but from the blow, a blow from the side, and sort of a twisting, torquing blow, and helmets, you know, that have essentially no impact. You know, the sport that has a helmet that where it has been extremely effective and often for blows from the side is car racing. Mm. But those helmets come right down to the shoulders, and they really kind of, you know, almost prevent the twisting, spinning move of the head. And so they're not helmets that really can be adapted for the demands of hockey.
So in the book, you are calling for no more headshots and no finishing the check. What sort of response are you getting from fans?
Well, you know, we'll see. But, I mean, I think that the question, I mean, you start with any kind of suggestion of change, you know, is that, well, we can't do that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the game. I mean, this is how the game is played. Okay, so you start with that response. And then that's why I went into, you know, a lot of depth about the nature of the game and how it has changed overwhelmingly since its beginnings in 1875. So just to get out of the way that notion that the game can't be changed because the game is the game. If you were a real purist and a real traditionalist, which suggests that you know about the game, you would know about all of these changes. But if you actually do know about them, you've forgotten. And so I just want to remind you of the fact that hockey was once a game without substitutions and a game where without a forward pass. So let's just start with the notion that hockey is always changing.
Yeah.
And change of speed because of changing shifts and the equipment, the sticks are so much lighter. It's not a matter of laying on the lumber anymore. You've got something that's a whole lot lighter. And the effect of slashes and things like that, except to the hands, where the equipment has become much less because players want to be able to manipulate the stick, so they want you something less. You know, all of these things have changed. So you, the fan, or you, the media critic, or any, just stop for a second and realize that it's always changing. Okay, so now that you are in that state of mind to wonder about whether a game can be changed that way and in terms of head hits. Let's also go into, you know, your history as a traditionalist and a purist to know that there are already penalties against head hits. One of them is called elbowing. You don't elbow somebody to their shoulder. You elbow to their head. That was understood as a vulnerability of players, you know, right from the beginning, so there were elbowing penalties. Similarly, high sticking, you know, is that you don't high stick a shoulder, you high stick a head.
Mm.
And so, you know, that there was a penalty that was, you know, created decades and decades ago for high sticking. So we always have understood that the head is a vulnerable area, and because it's a vulnerable area, that what we will do is we will have special penalties for the head. Okay, so now we move forward to a time where we've got this additional speed, and where it used to be understood that the instrument that was the greatest, you know, cause of vulnerability on the ice was the stick. And so, you know, that the league makers or rule makers in the leagues and fans would say, well, you've got a choice here. If a player is going to get angry, you know, better that he doesn't use the stick as his instrument of anger. Better that they uses his fist, because you can't do much damage with a fist, and you can do a lot of damage with a stick. Well, times have changed, and as we talked about before, the stick is lighter. Mm-hmm. The stick doesn't have much force in it itself. The stick actually isn't nearly as dangerous. The helmet can do a pretty good job of protecting against the stick. But really, you know, you still want to have those protections against the stick. But the most dangerous instrument on the ice now is the body, because it is this instrument that is big. I mean, it's over 200 pounds, I'm sure, for the average player with their equipment on. And you got a lot of players that are a lot more than 200 pounds. Mm-hmm. And you've got speeds, you know, high speeds, and you've got the force of these collisions. Well, you know, that the force of that body moving at that speed, running into a head, that is a pretty significant thing. So, okay, now you've got this, you know, this fan and this critic who's saying, well, no way, you can't change my game. You know, knowing that a game can be changed, and knowing some of the dangers that come from a game that has changed. And now you've got, you know, somebody who knows that much better the life of somebody who is affected by an injured brain. And it's not a very nice thing. And it's a life that's a pretty lousy life. So if you've right away you've said, no way, no chance, on all the rest of it, maybe you start to think about it, you know, again. And you go to some of the things that the NHL has done with automatic penalties. One of them that is in terms of shooting the board, the puck over the glass when you're in your own defensive zone. That used to be something that seemed to be outrageous to that same fan. How can you give a penalty for something the puck was flipping on him? It's no big deal. I mean, you know, that he didn't intend to. Now our team is, chances are, it's, you know, that you already got a penalty. Now it gives the team a second penalty. Now they're two men short. Now there's a really good chance that a goal is going to be scored. You can't do that. So it started out with all kinds of arguments, and this is a dumb rule, and the commentators saying it's a dumb rule. Well, guess what? Within a very short period of time, it is what it is. You know, no arguments anymore. You go to the box. It seems like a dumb rule, but you live with it. You adapt to it. You know, the game goes on. Life goes on. Another rule, you know, same sort of thing. A stick to your opponent's face. Mm-hmm. You know, a penalty. It's an automatic penalty. At first, all kinds of arguments. He didn't intend to do it. His stick deflected off his opponent's stick, or deflected off his arm. Or, in fact, the opponent, you know, kind of lowered his head a little bit. I mean, you can't give him a penalty for that. He didn't intend to do it. Well, you know, the penalty was given. What happened? The arguments end after a while. You go to the box. Now, no big deal. Teams adapt. You get on with it. Well, those are significantly less dangerous, you know, important penalties than a hit to the head. And if you ever listen to the commentators after somebody, you know, there's been a hit, and they're wondering whether the player should have gotten the game misconduct, whether he should be suspended or not, listen to the discussion. And I end up, you know, referring to one of them, you know, in the book. Mm-hmm. End of where, you know, did the guy lower his head a little bit? Did he not? Should he have seen him coming? Did the guy who hit him, did he target the head? Did he not? I think he did a little bit. Did he want to hurt him? Did he not? You know, it's all this stuff of explanations, excuses for this, and the central point in all of it is, guess what? The brain doesn't distinguish. Yeah. It doesn't distinguish between whether it was intended, whether it wasn't, whether it was targeted, whether it wasn't, you know, whether, you know, any of these things are the case. The central question has to do with the brain, you know, with the person being hit rather than the hitter. It's about the effect, not the cause. And so, you know, it's a hit to the head, and just like with a shot over the boards or the stick to the face, it's a penalty. And the harder the hit, the bigger the penalty. Yeah. And teams have a way of adapting because players adapt, coaches adapt. That's what they do all the way along. So the easy pass off critic, you know, and fans say, hey, you can't do that. Yeah. You know, this is the game. Well, garbage. And guess what? You can do something about it, and teams and players and the game is doing something about these things all the time.
So do you think, Ken, that Gary Bettman and people like him in the NHL get it and will do something shortly?
We will see. I mean, that's you know, the idea of the book is lay out the story, lay it out as fully and completely as you can. All of those things. First of all, you start with a life, and here's the life, and here's what it's like, you know, to live a life after you've had, you know, some brain injury. Okay. Second of all, the science. You want the answer to be science. You know, better diagnosis, better treatment. Guess what? Science takes time. Games are played tomorrow. Science is something that you engage in, do all kinds of work on a parallel track, but you need, you know, that what decision makers do is you take the best science available at any time and you apply that science, and that's what you do. The next part, you know, of the book is tracing the path of the game, you know, and so that it's laid out there. You know, where we are, how we got here, why we got here, what the implications are of being here, and then you get to, okay, you know, that what is the way out of this problem? Don't just, you know, tell me a problem. Don't just make me more aware. Tell me how we get, you know, what is the answer? So that's the idea of the book. It is laying out all of these things that somebody will have a pet response to and say, oh, no, it's not, it's really a helmet. No, it's not this, it's that. No, well, guess what? It isn't the helmet. Let's get on to the next thing that is your pet theory. No, it's not that either. Let's get down to what it really is. It's the way in which we play. Okay, now, you know, how do we get at the way in which we play and play in a different enough way that, you know, that the numbers of concussions gets reduced hugely, and at the same time, it's still as exciting to play and still as exciting to watch. And that's what the book is about.
Yeah.
And so it is essentially written for, you know, those who are the decision makers. And to say, you know, that as I say in the book, the impact on players like Steve and lots of others is that it's not fair, it's not right, and crucially, it's not necessary. That is the thing. There are lots of things in life that aren't fair and aren't right, but there's nothing we can do anything about them. Well, in this case, we can. This is all not necessary. There are answers to this, and they're very doable answers.
And the life of Steve Montador, I mean, that's his legacy there, isn't it? That we're able to talk about these things and hopefully see change very soon.
Well, that's what one hopes. And if you're, you know, if you were a friend of Steve Montador's, if you're a member of the family, or if any other player, you know, who has had, you know, brain injuries and the impact, and it's not just CTE.
Yeah.
It's lots of conditions, you know, that are far short of CTE. What you want, if you are one of those people, more than anything, is you want something a little bit good to come out of something very bad. That's what you want desperately. And so that's why I wrote the book, and that's why when once it is written, and usually, you know, that's sort of the end of things, and is that, no, this is the beginning of things. Mm. This is, the idea is that this is the beginning of the kind of challenging, forceful conversation that leads to changes that are of the dimension of the problem. And anybody can say they're doing something. Well, something is close to nothing unless it relates to the dimensions of the problem. And so that's what, you know, that's what all of this is working towards.
It's an very beautifully written book, and congratulations on it and good luck with it.
Well, thanks a lot and good luck to you.
The book is called Game Change, The Life and Death of Steve Montador and the Future of Hockey. It's published by Signal, which is an imprint of McClelland and Stewart. Ken Dryden, its author, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.